And now Iowa Contemporary Art presents Icon Art Radio.
Hi, this is Bill Teeple and Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. At our last Odd Thursday, we were discussing the creative process, and one of the points that came out was bringing truthfulness to the execution of our work and the emphasis on process. Donna has brought a quote by Henry Miller that continues the thought.
And before I read the quote, I'd like to mention the book the quote came from. It's a book called Creators on Creating that has wonderful essays by people like Henry Miller, Fellini, Richard Feynman, Annie Dillard, Rilke, Ursula Le Guin, and Frank Zappa, to name a few. And they're all writing in these essays about, and some of them are just interviews where they are talking about their own creative process and the experiences they have. So this was from Henry Miller's. He said, "Every day we slaughter our finest impulses. That is why we get a heartache when we read those lines written by the hand of a master and recognize them as our own, as the tender shoots which we stifled because we lacked the faith to believe in our own powers, our own criterion of truth and beauty. Every man, when he gets quiet, when he becomes desperately honest with himself, is capable of uttering profound truths."
I love this quote. It just says it all. This is like what we were trying to get at, and what I was trying to get at in our discussion the other night. The thing ticked off something for you when we mentioned this earlier.
Well, actually, it just ticked a different thing, which is that phrase, desperately honest. And I guess in many contexts in life, we don't really get fully honest until the chips are down, as they say, or it's, you know, the issues are profound, the stakes are major. But it's an interesting notion that, you know, we tend to kind of build bubbles around ourselves and live inside of them where everything is really going according to a pattern that we've established, and we're not actually interacting with life or the universe or the world in any particular way. We're kind of recapitulating our own little mini myth. You know, what he's suggesting is that it's when we break out of that bubble that we actually, the things start to get profound. Mm. And I think, I mean, I notice it all the time. I realize I've been doing the same thing for 3 days. And I think, wow, wait a minute. I have no idea why I'm doing any of these things. I'm just doing them because they're there to do. And I'm not actually engaging in what I'm doing.
Which is why people are, in some strange sense, attracted to big tragedies.
Yeah.
When, like, Katrina happened,
sure.
September 11th, you find people being saddened and horrified by it, but at the same time, you find it bringing out this desperate honesty that the quote talks about and bringing people together.
Right, or thrill-seeking. You know, it's why people like to drive really fast and do things that are life-threatening, because it puts them into the present, pulls them out of the past and the future. So I guess Miller is, you know, saying kind of from a different perspective that you know, desperate truth is really just the present.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's nothing desperate about it. It's just some people may not experience it unless they're in dire straits.
Well, I used to say, I just remembered this. I hadn't said this for years, that the authentic artistic voice comes from the same place as the last words of the condemned man on the gallows tower.
Oh, dear.
That's when you really have to get honest. I mean,
when did you start saying that?
I don't know, 10 years ago or something. But I mean, because I was interested in this very point.
Mm. Yeah.
What do you? Because you're always fooling yourself. You're always telling stories to yourself.
Yeah.
That about.
About the bubble.
This is what I, yeah, it's all the yeah. bubble. And it's all, you know, this is what I say when someone says that.
Right.
And then you watch yourself say what you say when someone says that.
Right. Mm.
But the studio is the place, I've always thought of the studio as kind of like the gallows tower. This is the yeah. place that you have to get honest with yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking directly to God and you know you're about to be judged or something and you're judging yourself.
And yeah. the spark can come from nothing. You know, it does not necessarily have to come from the gallows or some tragedy, but it can come from the simple recognition that you're aging, for example, or
well, that's the gallows
whatever,
tower.
You know, that's the gallows tower.
How long do you stand there before the trap goes down?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I actually had this experience last week. On Friday, I was going to go up with the Icon group to see Charlotte Kane's show in Des Moines, and I couldn't go because I had hurt my foot, and so I couldn't walk around all day. And I went up to my studio that morning because I've been kind of painting regularly in my studio since I moved into my new house. And I don't know whether it had any relationship to my hurting my foot or what it was, but that particular morning, I somehow... something got peeled away that gave me more courage to express what I really had been wanting to express for probably 4 decades. And didn't have, like he was saying in the quote, kept slaughtering those fine impulses because somehow I was comparing my impulses to other people's impulses or to the art world or to some standards I had or whatever. And so, and something about that morning made me just say, I'm just going to do this, and I don't care what happens. And something came out from that I can't even evaluate as a product, but as something that made me feel more authentic than I have felt in my studio probably ever. Mm. And when I finished, I've been painting since that day for like 3 hours to 5 hours every day, and when I finish, I feel like I have just been with somebody who I absolutely adored more than anybody in the world. It's like you were talking, Bill, before about art being a process of love. And that's what it feels like. It's like just doing that act and expressing those things that are just coming out authentically makes me feel that kind of energy. Like, wow, I float around my lunch and just feel that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is what it's all about. What the artist... job and what they're supposed to do in the studio is figure out a way to get to this place, and then whatever happens will be authentic. It'll be his authentic voice, and rather than starting with the idea of coming up with a product, and the product has to fit certain understandings of what an artwork is and all of this, all of the authentic changes in the history of mankind or in the history of art came from someone slipping in accidentally to that place or figuring out a way to get there and stop slaughtering all the tender impulses.
Mm. Yeah, I was, when I first heard that quote, I was reminded of a quote by D.T. Suzuki in his famous book, Essays on Zen Buddhism. And I read this long, long before I had any clue what Buddhism had to do with anything or Zen. And yet there was something about this that stuck permanently in my mind. And I can almost quote it verbatim. Is not life one as we live it, which we recklessly cut to pieces by applying the murderous scalpel of intellectual surgery?
very good.
Well, that's good. That's really good because in this like recent experience in my studio, one of the things that's so blissful is I've been working as a writer for many decades and using the fine scalpel of intellect to say things very precisely, mm-hmm. to try to express what I really had inside to express. And in working with these colors and forms in the studio, what I'm feeling this week is the reason why the writing was starting to drive me a little crazy was because I couldn't ever say it precisely enough. And so what's been happening lately is I realize that what I've been trying to say is not intellectual. And that's why I can't say it that way, by using these fine discriminatory abilities, so that I can't even explain these paintings.
Yeah.
There's nothing to explain about them, but at the same time, they are saying what I wanted to say so much more thoroughly.
Yeah. Well, this is, to me, this is where, you know, poetry and prose diverge.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sort of an assumption in the context of prose that you really are trying to define something or explain something or, you know, put boundaries around something. And in the case of poetry, you're really trying to evoke something or, mm-hmm. You know, recreate something. And the things that I write about in poetry are things that would take volumes of essays to, you know, sort of crudely map out the territory. And the subtleties of it, the intricacies of that perception are simply not communicable at all. Mm-hmm. They're for me to experience in my own world, and that's it. I can't give those experiences to anybody. And if I try to describe them in accurate detail, I could write 10 volumes and accomplish very little. Or I can write one poem, which, if I'm lucky, will at least evoke the location of that experience. You'll get there, and then you'll have your experience of something analogous. But the actual thing that I would like to express isn't expressible.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to sort of pick my tool to suit what it is that I'm trying to get across. And poetry is just, for me, just wonderfully non-analytical.
It goes back to something we talked about a few shows ago about the importance being the questions and not the answer, because it seems like what you express when you write a poem or you paint something that's just so intangible in terms of meaning, that it's satisfying because you're putting out the blend of those questions that you have inside you. And there's something about expressing just the mix of those questions in a way different from just trying to ask it and as one question.
I would even go so far as to say that poetry has a chance of answering the question, whereas the intellect only has the capacity to ask the question. The intellect just flat out doesn't answer questions.
Because the poem answers the question, including the on the other hands. In other words, it's not saying, it's not answering the question definitively, it's answering the question that
sort of
this and on the other hand and on the other hand and on the other hand are all like part of the answer that the question's bringing
And that's
out.
Why I like mythology, because mythology sets off an archetypal pattern in human awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone recognizes that pattern. And it always goes awry when someone now sets forth to explain the myth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I always like to tell a story, a mythic story, because it contains a seed value in human existence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And every culture has their own sort of way of telling that particular pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel, and depending on how awakened the person's sensibilities are to that, everybody gets it to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
The seed of the thing.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about mythology.
Yeah.
But it always goes weird when I try to explain it to someone anyone writes.
Course.
I mean, we know it's going to, but you try. Well, I've learned not to.
Yeah.
But if you even try to give a little bit of a push to explain it,
Yeah.
It completely collapses into a very...
Well, it's because the myth is an interesting blend of prose and poetry. The myth is usually told in poetry, in poetic language.
Right.
And the elements of the story of a myth are charged with meaning, as are all the words in a poem. Whereas when you try to explain it, you're in a sense you're deflating all of those special charged terms and reducing them to explanations and definitions and relationships and things. And you can, in the myth or the poem, and I guess here we're saying in the epic poem of Gilgamesh or the Mahabharata or whatever it is, you are presenting these cosmic concepts and universal ideas in elemental form.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not describing or defining them, even though you may go on for 20 pages describing the armor that, you know, somebody is wearing before he goes into battle.
Which is why it's kind of sad that a lot of us, our first introduction to mythology or mythic civilizations is in school,
mm-hmm.
with a textbook where we have, you know, the whole thing is overly explained and it just becomes boring. Whereas if we just happen to watch some special on the Discovery Channel or something on TV and we see some primitive civilization enacting their mythology and doing some dance around a fire in their costumes and all that, we may not have any idea what this represents to that society, but we feel the power of it and we're just like mesmerized by what we're seeing them do.
And of course, there's the overanalysis of poems.
Like, oh, absolutely.
It's important to give someone an angle on how to enjoy poems, understanding metaphor and all this stuff, and tell a person, oh yeah, that's how it works, or what we're dealing with here. But otherwise, it's just like breaking down, it's just like explaining the myth to break down the poems.
When I was in school, almost all of the English teachers, when they did their obligatory poetry teaching, did it by finding some, you know, classic poem and then painstakingly ripping it to shreds in front of us so that we could see, you know, how it worked. And, all right, there's some validity to that. You know, you can certainly learn something about a car engine by ripping it to shreds. Unfortunately, you probably won't learn enough to know why it really works or how to put it back together again or how to build one in the first place, which I would hope would be the purpose of teaching poetry in an English class in school. But I had one or two teachers who took the opposite tack. They would pick a poem in their minds and then they would describe to us the situation that the poet might have been in without telling us anything about the poet or the poem. And they would just build up in our minds this image of a situation and a reaction and how would you ever express that kind of experience? Then they would give us the poem and not tell us anything about how it was done. And we'd read the poem and think, wow, you know, that really does express that thing.
Yeah, and Billy Collins did that when he was Poet Laureate a few years ago. He, I guess when you're Poet Laureate, you have to do some kind of project that supports the cause of poetry in the United States. And his project was to go around to schools and kind of tune into what high school kids wanted to or needed, you know, to appreciate poetry more. And he wound up putting together a book, I think it was called Poetry 108, whatever the number it was the number of school days in a school year. And he very carefully chose 108 poems that were particularly would resonate with kids of that age group and from all contemporary or, you know, ancient poetry, whatever. And his assignment when he put this book out was that they would read, the students would, somebody would read aloud one of these poems each day in the school year with no comments, no studying, nothing, just reading these poems out. And the result was amazing. I mean, he's just gotten feedback from all over the country, mm-hmm. from students and parents and teachers who the kids made them want to read more poetry just on their own and dip into that.
you know, it's a delicate thing to separate and then reintegrate the elements of the craft from the process of the art. And like, you know, I remember thinking about composition in a good painting, or, you know, a painting that's particularly strong in composition, and thinking, you know, you can just look at the painting and experience it and not necessarily notice what it's doing to you and how it's kind of managing your own vision and directing your attention in very predictable ways, you know, back and forth across its surface. And yet it's probably important if you want to do paintings with, you know, very subtle kinds of composition, to have some understanding of that mechanism. On the other hand, you know, we can surmise that maybe some great painters just had a sense of it and never actually thought about it analytically.
It's probably a cart and horse situation.
Yeah, I think so.
If you don't want to, you know, if you get to a place where you're not killing those fine impulses that are coming naturally, then it's very helpful to study.
Yeah.
It's a dance. Yeah, it's sort of like juggling the two. You do that as a teacher, don't you?
Well, this is one of my very wiggly areas of concern as a teacher, because
I saw you wiggling when I started to talk about it.
I'm one of balance is my whole thing. I'm trying to estate. I want the student to be able to move like a dancer in a balanced way, and so you don't want to fall off, or like a tightrope walker. You try not to fall off the wire, but if you walk right across on that wire, it's beautiful. Mm. So this thing of learning, studying composition is one of the best ways to trample the fine impulses, mm-hmm. the natural, mm-hmm. subtle impulses. Yeah. So I teach, and I've gotten flack for this from people who think it's very important to study the principles of composition. But I sort of like do it more in an obligatory way than I do from my heart, mm-hmm. which means I'm trampling my own fine impulses as a teacher. Yeah. I'm not careful. But I teach people to feel lines of force, mm-hmm. and to feel what they feel in their body. So in other words, you make some lines on your page and you're going to set up a direction of force. Mm-hmm. It's only natural, and then I ask the student to feel in their body what they're feeling and their emotion. What are you feeling now when you look at these marks you made? There'll be a natural tendency to want to redirect the force, to keep the energy within the picture plane instead of mm-hmm. all just pouring out. So if a force goes one way, you will tend to counter it with another force that will, not because you're supposed to, but because it's your insides want that to happen now.
Yeah, it creates the balance.
And then you'll want to like create another force that kind of balances that. So it's mm-hmm. all a matter of balancing feelings inside yourself. Mm-hmm. So I give emphasis as a teacher to this.
Yeah.
And then I have them look at it, and then we look at, you know, we can analyze after the fact using the intellect to decide, you know, maybe what's going on, and that's mm-hmm. helpful. But the rules that you always put the center of interest on the third point, I won't go into it now, and that you never have a hurdle to get, and you never put something in the middle, and that you always do this and that. And there are rules that have been taught forever and ever, mm-hmm. and these seem to be the guidelines that much of the great art is structured on. And I think a lot of it is structured more on the intuitive level than it is on the following the rules, because I find that students that try to apply the rules, or even good, in quotes, paintings mm-hmm. that are done by the rules, there's a sort of, they all look alike, and none of them break through to this thing that Henry Miller's talking about.
Yeah.
And this guy, just the other night on that video that we watched, he was a very straight, realistic painter. But he brought interest to his paintings by setting the challenge for himself to break the rules of composition.
You break the rules for a reason. It's like Cézanne, for example, when he decided he was going to scrap the whole concept of a vanishing point, which artists had been using, you know, for centuries. And so he was going to show spatial relationship in a different way. And so he had a motivation for breaking that rule because of something that he wanted to explore. Where was I going to go with this? I had a reason for saying that. I'll probably come back to that in a minute.
Well, I've made a similar kind of observation in writing, particularly in editing, because I've edited a lot of material that other people wrote, ranging from Maharshi to, you know, all the original faculty at MIU and things. And what I've found in asserting the rules of grammar is that the rules of grammar are not rules. They're an observation, and they shouldn't be taught as rules, but they're basically an observation of what successful writing tends to do. If you have written well, then you'll find certain characteristics in the use of words and the use of punctuation. It's why the series comma is so incredibly important, even though people can make arguments for using as few commas as possible and things like that. There's just flat out ambiguity if you don't use it, and there isn't any ambiguity if you do use it. And you remembered what you were going to say.
I just remembered what I was going to say.
Okay, well, you got 1 minute.
We got
and
one.
30
I can
seconds
say it fast.
To do it.
So it's just it depends on what rules you follow or don't follow. Depend on what you want to say.
Right.
And so it's a matter
absolutely.
Of expressing the language, like, you know, Gertrude Stein, James Joyce, people who did abandoned certain rules of grammar and punctuation had a reason for doing that because it allowed them to express what they wanted to express more effectively. And so it's the same thing with painting. If you break a rule, Gauguin, he, you know, completely shifted the rules of composition and made these figures like coming off the side and exiting the picture plane, had a reason to do that, and he said what he wanted to say better by doing that. But you have to know that. It's a conscious.
There's nothing gained
thing.
In just breaking rules to be breaking rules.
Right.
The only reason to do anything is to try to desperately get truthful with yourself and everybody else.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's the same you know, among all the other choices that you make creatively, whether to say it as a poem or as an essay or as a painting or as a photograph, and whether to, you know, use punctuation in the poem or not, whether to allow yourself to make up words or use a hammer instead of a screwdriver. And I guess that brings us to the end of today's show.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.